Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this call. My name is Sylva LeDuc. I'm the owner of Sage Leadership Strategies, and I'm also the program chair for IMC Arizona for 2009. At the beginning of this week, we had such a flurry of activity of people signing up for this first summer teleconference series with Alan Weiss. And when I checked the registration, it was really interesting to find out that half the people on this call are coaches and the other half are consultants. So the coaches are coming from the International Coach Federation, and of course the consultants are coming from IMC, the Institute for Management Consultants. I think the only group that we're missing today are the people from the National Speakers Association, although I know that a lot of folks that are on this call are members of both NSA, ICF, as well as IMC. So we are going to get started. We have a very rich conversation that's going to occur, and it's with Alan Weiss, the Million Dollar Consultant, also known as the Contrarian Consultant, and he's the Architect of Communities. And we're going to get into the meaning behind all of that. So I can go on at length about Alan. I think that everybody on this call knows Alan Weiss through his podcasts, certainly his books, his 32 books. And I'm sure that is another three or four that are coming out this year, Alan?
As a matter of fact, yes. I'm finishing one in the next month.
Excellent. So we are going to be talking with him regarding writing and books, articles, publications, what that does in terms of helping a consultant or a coach gain credibility as well as visibility. We'll be talking with him about social media. That was one of the favorite questions that came forward. We did run an Ask Alan contest, and we've chosen two questions that we will be definitely discussing today. And those are interesting questions in respect to what the economy is like in Phoenix, with Phoenix being 97-some percent comprised of small business of less than 100. And actually, small businesses in Phoenix are usually less than 20 individuals. At 100 is typically regarded as being a larger business. Alan has been in consulting for over 20 years. He's worked with some of the largest organizations in the world, and one of his major clients for many, many years was Merck. And find out some more information about that first engagement that you had and what the result was. So is there anything else that you want to add, Alan, rather than me go on at length?
Well, I don't know. Do we still have any time left? Whatever you want to cover, go right ahead.
All right. Well, let's get started with talking about value-based billing. And I know that's something you cover in the workshops and the programs that you deliver. It's in your books. And for a lot of individuals, I think they still don't get it. I have changed my model to value-based billing, and it's been an incredible change for my business. So would you start with an overview of what that is and how to accomplish value-based billing?
Well, the fact is that consultants historically billed by the hour, just as lawyers did, and it's just a dumb way to bill, and it's dumb because the hour, the time unit, isn't really worth anything. I still hear people in the IMC walking around telling me that they're going to a conference on how to determine how to best bill by the hour. It's just nonsense, and the reason is that what we do as consultants or trainers or facilitators or coaches or whatever is that we provide results, and the results are what's important, and the results are what you charge on. And so charging for time is silly. And besides, it captures income. And I also maintain it's basically unethical. That is, the client requires something to be solved or improved as rapidly as possible. The consultant only makes money when the consultant's there as long as possible. And so to me, there's an inherent ethical conflict. If I can solve something for a client in 20 minutes, I'm worth a whole lot more than somebody who takes 2 months and charges, $300 an hour. So in 1992, Million Dollar Consulting came out, and in 85, when I went out on my own, one of the decisions I made was to bill only based on value, never by a time unit, and that's what I did, and I popularized it. I was the pioneer in this for solo consultants in 92. Now Value-Based Fees is out, a book which is in its second edition. Million Dollar Consulting will come out in about 2 months from now in its fourth edition, which is just about unheard of for a book like that being on the shelves for, 17 years. And so we know that it works. I mean, people said it can't work in Germany. I have somebody in my mentor program in Germany who's changed his entire practice, his entire company to value-based billing and does the equivalent of $2.5 million just on value-based billing. I was told it couldn't work in services. It can. It can't work in manufacturing consulting. It can. And so the whole point is not to focus on the input side, the task side, the deliverable side. There's a term human resource people love, deliverables. But the output side, what's the increased profit? What's the reduced stress? What's the increased retention? And you can do that if you position yourself properly and ask the right questions. It's really as simple as that.
And when I was with Ernst & Young in 97, that's when I first learned about value-based billing. And you really caused a stir within that organization. And we tried to go in that direction. And I think it's because it was an accounting style of consulting firm that the mindset could not be wrapped around value-based billing. So it was abandoned. You've also, though, worked within large consulting firms, those big four, big five, I guess the big four, big three now. How did you get them to transfer or transition?
Well, as you can tell, pretty soon it's going to be the big one. The fact is that their infrastructure and their method of doing business, which is basically to have hundreds of people sitting at desks whom you're paying $200 an hour and send them out to clients at $400 an hour. I mean, that's their basic business model, which is so stupid, I wouldn't let my German Shepherd use it. And so when you go into these big, you know, when I was working with Anderson, for example, we picked a practice at the time it was outsourcing. That made sense because it was a complete practice. That is, it was a self-contained practice. And the people who ran it were interested in trying value-based fees because they realized the ridiculous nature of this hourly billing. And I remember we made a very successful conversion in outsourcing, and at one point they placed a piece of business for $457,000. And the accounting side of Anderson, the back room, turned it down, and they said it doesn't fit in the boxes. You have to show us so much per hour for this kind of activity and this kind of person in the company. And they said, we're not putting it through. And so the head of the heads of the outsourcing operation said to me, what do you think we should do here? I said, go to the general manager and tell the general manager that he has two choices. He can accept value-based billing at $457,000 and tell the accounting people to draw bigger boxes, or he can tell you that he accepts the accounting people's decision, and if you did this by their definition, you'd have about a $185,000 project. So tell him to make the decision. Well, he made that decision in maybe 19 seconds.
Yeah.
and the accounting people drew bigger boxes. And so that's how you get people to change. You show them that it's in their self-interest. You show them you can make much more money with much less labor intensity. See, right now, Syl, the large consulting firms, some of the people who are listening to this, are not really driven by their expertise. They're driven by production capability.
Mm-hmm.
They're driven by how many hours they can use and how much they'll be paid for the hours. A lot of training firms are driven by production capability. It's how many boxes of material or how many heads in the classroom or how many internet downloads they can drive. That's not the business I want to be in. And so it just amounts to complete foolishness. Real wealth is discretionary time. I'll tell you one quick story. You know, there's going to be an NSA conference in Phoenix where you are in the next, I guess, later this month or next
yes.
month. You know, I'm not going to be there because I just don't want to visit the surface of the sun at this time. But I was at a conference in Dallas, and I was playing hooky as usual, and I was out by the pool, and there's just me and a woman there. That's it. And I'm an introvert. I don't like to make conversation. But she looks up at me, and I said hello, and she said hello, and she said, are you a speaker? I said, yes. I said, are you? She said, no, my husband's a speaker, but this is the only time I get to spend time with him at these conventions. And so I looked around. Her husband was not in sight. So I looked at the bottom of the pool to see if he had drowned. And nowhere in sight. So I said, well, where is he? She said, well, he had to attend this one session, she said. But, you know, he has 110 dates a year, so he travels 220 days. Each takes an average of a day. And she said, I barely ever see him, you know. And I said, if I may ask, what does he charge? And she didn't know who on earth I was, and so she said, well, he charges $1,100 a day.
Ouch.
Which, yeah, it's preposterous. And so I said to her, you know, if I may make a suggestion, if he doubled his fee, he could travel half the time, make the same money, and have all that more time with you. And she said something to me that was just stereotypical of speakers and consultants and coaches who have low self-esteem. She said, oh, he could never charge that. Well, if you believe that, you can't. And that's the trouble with the profession. And that's why so many people are in my community and on Allen's forums and the Million Dollar Consulting College and reading my newsletter and everything else, because they need to get into a different mindset.
And self-esteem, we're going to get into that definitely. And that's the first sale, isn't it, is to oneself.
First sale is to yourself. And when I first began coaching other consultants, you know, when I because I was primarily an OD consultant. I was dealing with, as you mentioned, Merck and Hewlett-Packard and the Federal Reserve and Mercedes-Benz and all these people. But when Million Dollar Consulting came out and then this second market opened for me of coaching individual consultants and small consulting firms and so on, I was convinced that the trouble with consultants was that they were undercapitalized. They didn't have enough money to see themselves through bad times. And, of course, I was wrong. You know, I'm always surprised how stupid I was 2 weeks ago. The problem with consultants and coaches and facilitators and trainers and solo practitioners and entrepreneurs is that many have low self-esteem. And so they cannot stand up and say to a buyer, the fee is $55,000. They're afraid to say to a human resources person, I can't talk to you about this. I need to talk to the decision maker. I've actually had people who I'm coaching say to me, but why would he want to listen to me? Well, if that's what you believe, he doesn't want to listen to you.
You're not a peer.
Well, in fact, I'm having trouble listening to you. You know?
So they are undercapitalized mentally.
Well, you could look at it that way. That's right. And now the good and bad news is it's correctable.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be willing to take steps to correct it. And if you're going to hang out with people and commiserate with people who have the same sort of victimology mentality and go around saying that you work backwards from your lifestyle to determine how much money you charge per hour and tell you that you should be dealing with training departments and human resource departments, if that's who you're going to pal around with, you know, I got news for you. Get into another line of work.
Yeah. I was in a conversation with someone yesterday who said this person was involved in training. Oh, there's just no money. And I thought, uh-huh, you're right. In training department with HR, there isn't any money. But if you're going at to a higher level, of course there's money. And I just thought, I'm not going to get into that conversation because it becomes trying to convince somebody that they need to be working at a higher level and that they are a peer. So I want to go back to something that you mentioned just a minute ago, and it was Merck, and I'd mentioned this already. What was your first engagement as a solo practitioner or as a solo entrepreneur?
You mean with Merck?
With Merck. It's the story I heard about when they approached you.
Yeah, what happened was Merck called me. A fellow there in human resources knew me from a prior life. He knew me from when I was with a training firm. And I had taken pains to let everybody know what I was doing. You know, that basically when I got fired from a firm here in Rhode Island, I let everybody know what I was doing so they could find me. And that's what I counsel everybody today. You know, I'll call everyone you know, let them know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy got a hold of me and he said, look, we got a project here. And we can't do it internally because of the politics. And I think you're the right guy for this. But I need for you to come down and meet my boss. I said, fine. So I went down to Rawway at the time where they were headquartered. Now they're out in White House Station. And I met with his boss, he was the director of human resources. His boss was the vice president of human resources. And we established rapport, and then he introduced me to the president of the company at the time, the CEO, Roy Vagelos. And they had a very sensitive project. They needed to do a baseline study on diversity. And you know, Vagelos talked to me about my background and what I thought about it, and I talked to him. Very tough customer. I mean, you want to talk about the need not to be intimidated. He said to me at one point, you know, I'm a physician as well, because he came out of the National Institute of Health. And I said, really? He said, yeah. And you know what happens, he says to me, when people go to their physician and then come to me and I give a different diagnosis? I said, no, what happens? He said, their physician's wrong. Very tough cookie. Now, under his aegis there, under his leadership, they won America's Most Admired Company 5 years in a row. And then they would each year they gave employees gifts, different gifts. And they gave me a gift every single year.
Mm-hmm.
So that started, that diversity study I did for them, started a chain of working with them for 12 years and maybe 36 projects. And not only did I do over $2 million of work with Merck itself, but the spin-off business from that, because at the time, if you worked with Merck, you know, it was magic. The spin-off business was in the millions and millions. And to this day, I exchange Christmas cards and an occasional email during the year with the guy who first brought me in, who's now retired, still living in New Jersey, and we still talk. So that's my story with Merck.
So my two takeaways from that, one is that you maintain contact because you've established relationship for long periods. It's not going in. It's not transactional. This is a relationship you're establishing. The other is I'm hearing the fourth sale. Always remember the fourth, the fifth, the tenth sale, not just going in once. So talk more about that in terms of how it both of those relate to self-esteem for coaches and consultants.
Well, the toughest thing is new business acquisition. The easiest thing is getting referral business and repeat business. But consultants and coaches and so forth tend to disregard that. And so they don't ask for referrals, which is really the coinage of our realm.
Mm-hmm.
They're bashful. They have low self-esteem. They won't go to a buyer and say, hey, look, this project's gone well. We've agreed on the objectives. We're hitting those objectives. Are you as happy as I am? The buyer says, yeah, it's gone great. You say, fine. Listen, referrals are how I do business, and I wonder, can you give me three names of people who you think could also avail themselves of this, either inside the company or outside the company, people in another division, people who are suppliers, people who are vendors, you know, people who are customers. And you have to do that all the time, and by all the time, I mean at least quarterly. And so within Merck itself, I developed, you know, a couple of dozen buyers. One guy, for 3 years, bought $250,000 of consulting services from me every year and paid me on January 2nd every year to get a 10% discount. And his title was Manager of International Development. But he was a buyer. He had budget. And so you never know who's a buyer by their business card. And in a large company like Merck or Mercedes or Toyota, you can't just go by titles. You have to understand what they can do. Because a senior vice president in HR, which sounds like a lofty position, often is not a buyer.
Yeah.
So you have to go by that. And you have to have the self-esteem and the confidence to understand that what you're doing is not trying to get business. What you're doing is providing value. People ask me, well, how can you sell teleconferences? How can you sell books? How can you provide this? I don't look at it that way. I'm providing value to different people in different forms according to different learning styles. And besides, and if the people listening take nothing else away from this, you know, we develop something at the $1 Million Club, which I run twice a year. These are people making seven figures in the business. We're meeting in St. Lucia in November. We meet all over the world at the greatest locations. And out of the first $1 Million Club, this came out of it. It was the accelerant curve. And the accelerant curve says, allow people to be able to work with you at a low barrier to entry, at a low cost, but impersonally, so that they can sort of get in the groove. And so if you sell books or free teleconferences or teleconferences for money or anything like that where people can get to work with you on an inexpensive basis, even though it's impersonal, they will graduate, they will escalate, they will migrate to higher-end things. So, for example, you still have been through the $1 Million Consulting College, which is a very expensive offering I have, but it's 4.5 days. There's nothing else like it. And so people tend to migrate down that curve, and that's what you have to provide. So the self-esteem issue is, if you're convinced you're providing value for people, then you have to constantly search for different vehicles and different manners in which to provide that value.
And I really like the use of the accelerant curve as opposed to what I've heard elsewhere, which is the marketing funnel. Because that marketing funnel, I think about all the things that go in and that can be that are typically free, and there might be more of the higher priced service offerings or value offerings that come out at the end. The difference for people that are on this call, the accelerant curve really is like a skier who's at the top looking down and he's going to make a jump. He or she is going to make a jump. So as that curve comes down, they are going faster and faster. Of course, there's the more inexpensive or the free that are on websites or giveaways at speaking engagements. And then as people get to know one, the acceleration, it just increases because of that credibility that's been established and the trust that's been established. Let's go to your website just for a moment, because we can talk about the accelerant curve in terms of relationship to what you've done with your website, because I've done a lot of what you've done, not nearly as much, because I found that I have a particular tool that I use to see how what my hits are like on my site, and I thought, just for curiosity, I'd check yours. You have 400-plus pages on your website, which I found was absolutely astounding. So talk about the amount of intellectual property you give away and why you don't live in fear, like a lot of other people do, of having your IP stolen.
You know, until you just said that 20 seconds ago, I had no idea how many pages are on my website. I've never checked. I've never bothered. I don't care. I don't care how many hits I get. It makes no difference to me. All you need is one hit.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm constantly doing is putting out intellectual property. I've written more books on consulting than anyone else in history. If you are in the consulting business or allied businesses, I mean, I'm in the Speakers Hall of Fame, and you haven't heard of me, then you're just fooling around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't demand that you agree with me. I don't demand that you purchase anything from me. But if you haven't heard of me, then you're just fooling around. So that's the degree to which you want to build intellectual property. Now, there's a myth perpetuated by people who don't know any better that if you put intellectual property out there, it's dangerous because people will steal it. If you're going to go through life feeling that way, you better never get behind the wheel of a car where people are driving at 80 miles an hour on the highway 6 feet away from you. That's an act of faith. You have to have faith. What happens is this. The more intellectual property you put out, the more you become an object of interest to others. Years ago, I was on a committee that did a study for the National Speakers Association, and what we found is that which attracted buyers, and I'm not talking about bureaus and meeting planners who basically are not buyers, but that which attracted real buyers was expertise. And so consequently, when you put expertise out there, and it's expertise is manifest, the intellectual capital, which is between your ears, has to be manifest as intellectual property, and that can take the form of books or blogs or recordings or, you know, workshops or whatever. And once you get it out there, people want more and more of you. And so nobody thinks because they read Million Dollar Consulting, it's as good as attending the Million Dollar Consulting College. And nobody thinks that attending the Million Dollar Consulting College is as good as dealing with me personally in the mentor program for 6 months and so forth. So it just creates more and more allure. And you can't be afraid to put intellectual property out there, and you have to constantly be reinventing yourself. So my website was redone dramatically over the past year. We've got all kinds of video and audio and text on it. We're going to be launching something in the next few months called Allen and the Gang, mm-hmm. which will be an international destination for people who have questions about entrepreneurialism. It's going to be very exciting. So you have to keep doing that kind of stuff to draw people to you. So if you take a look, you know, in say in small business success, you've got David Meister. In sales, you've got Jeff Gittimer. In creativity and innovation, you've got Seth Godin. In coaching, you've got Marshall Goldsmith. And in solo consulting, you've got me. And, you know, I might be leaving out one or two people in other areas, but there's five examples right there. And so that's how you build that's how you become the top of the brand, the top of the niche, by consistently generating intellectual property that's in some form or other someone finds attractive, someone finds useful and pragmatic, and you never stop doing that.
And according to their learning style as well, that's what I appreciate about you having the video cast and the podcast, because someone doesn't just have to read. They can sit and watch you while they're doing something else. So you've made that shift just within the last, year or so, where you're utilizing more of the social media. And I'm not talking about Twitter, et cetera. I'm going to get into that in a little bit. But I'm talking about using those different modalities. So you have someone that does that for you. You don't waste your time trying to learn how to record with a flip video. You don't spend time trying to figure out how to use the different audio recording systems. Is that what you recommend for other people as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, the point is, what is the easiest thing for you to do, and what makes the best use of your time? So, for example, I just put up a podcast yesterday that people seem to love. I had some trick things in it. And a podcast, there's a microphone sitting about 4 feet away from me right now. And on my big Mac here, I have GarageBand. And I can record a podcast with the generic music that lasts 8 minutes in about 12 minutes. So I can do a podcast in 12 minutes. So I try to do two or three a week if I'm in the mood and I have something to say. So that's simple. Now, the writing on the wall is a monthly video that goes on my site. And I have a professional videographer who comes down here with an assistant, and they do the camera, lights, and sound. And we do that on my property, and we do five of them at a time in about an hour. And so I do one take. I never do two takes unless an airplane goes overhead. So in one take, I do five of these, and it's 90 minutes. It's an hour, and that's it. And I pay him for that. And I pay him for the editing, and he sends it to my webmaster. And now we're going to do the next ones we do next month. We're going to do in high def. And these are on YouTube, and my podcasts are on iTunes. I have Apple TV here, and it's hysterical because I can call up on my big screen TV my own videos and my own podcasts and everything else. I mean, it's just hysterical. So that's how I do that kind of stuff. Who can do it best and easiest, and what's the best use of my time? On my blog, for example, and I've been blogging for a couple of years now. We have thousands and thousands of entries in different media on the blog. I put up posts directly, but photos and video and podcasts I send to my webmaster, Chad Barr, who puts it up for me because it's easier for him to do it. He's got everything he needs to do it quickly, and that would be too much trouble for me. So you differentiate between what makes sense for you in terms of your time and what doesn't.
And you also talked about leveraging that I was hearing, because you're not doing the writing on the wall one at a time. You're doing five at a time. I was wondering if you did do that, because I thought, well, there's no change in season. It's the middle of winter. So thanks for that, because that makes much more sense for people. Even from the blogging perspective, some folks are doing five or six or ten blogs at a time and just setting them according to entry time. You're an individual who has an office in your home, and you had that since the very beginning. You've not wasted money by setting up an office elsewhere. So everything is set in place for you. Can you give us an idea of what a day in the life of Alan Weiss is like?
Well, let me tell you what today is like. I worked out in the morning, which means the dogs don't come with me. I work out every other morning. So when I don't work out, when I get up, the dogs hop in the truck with me. And we go for coffee, and they get some free biscuits from either Dunkin' Donuts or my coffee shop. But otherwise, today I worked out. I brought my car in. I dropped my wife off because she went over and picked me up. She works in a boutique on Fridays, and I use work advisedly. She's not paid. She gets a discount, which means I can't afford for her to work 2 days a week. Then I came back here, got myself cleaned up, checked out the pool, made sure it was in order. I did all my email. I posted on Twitter. I took care of the postings on Alan's forums, which is my international community, which you you can belong to in my community, or you can actually join Alan's forums. So I took
it's a wonderful resource.
Thank you, because I'm there two or three times a day. Then I had the interview with you. At noon today, I have a discussion with somebody who's going to do an interview with me tomorrow. We're going to set that up. At, 1 o'clock, I have a routine doctor's appointment. Then I'm going to do some writing in this book I told you I'm going to be finishing in the next month. Then I'm going to hit the pool. And at 6 o'clock, we have dinner, and 7:30, a play. So that's my day.
And what would what would the day should the day look like for someone that is just starting out in consulting or coaching?
Well, this is the marketing business, and so if you're just starting out, what you should be doing is focusing on two or three key marketing activities to get them working smoothly for you before you focus on the next two or three. So, for example, you should be spending maybe 30 to 60 minutes three times a week calling everyone you know. Now, that might be an email, but apprising them of what you're doing, asking if it would be of help to them, and asking if they have names for you for those people who could be of help to as well. If you are going to do networking, you should be spending one or two evenings a week networking. You should be joining and doing some pro bono work wherein you'll be elbow to elbow with potential buyers at a charity or a fundraiser or a political event or whatever it is. You should be looking to create speaking opportunities by sending out maybe a half dozen letters to the executive directors of trade associations who run associations where your buyers and recommenders will be in the audience. So, I could go on and on. It depends on what alternatives you use. I mean, you could be sending out letters of inquiry to get an article published. Mm-hmm. So it depends what vehicles you want to use, but that's what you need to be doing. You can't just sit by the phone. In fact, I got an email this morning from a mentoree who had sent out, she sent me a copy of a letter she was sending to trade associations, and I said it was a great letter, except the very end, which said, you can reach me at this number. I hope to hear from you. That's not what you put. What you put is, I'll call you Friday at 10 o'clock. This is the marketing business. You don't wait for the phone to ring. You go after people. So I would say that for the person you're talking about, Phil, if you look at a 40-hour week, plan to work 30 hours, give yourself 10 hours to do your own thing, and of those 30 hours, maybe you have a project you're implementing or maybe you have some things like that, but otherwise spend the time, divide it up so it's not onerous, getting your name out there, contacting people, and marketing. There's a lot of money out there in this market. You know, there are firms that are hiring. There are firms with money to invest. Make the firms that are doing the best your prospects. Don't bemoan the fact that your prospects, such as they are, might be hurt by the economy. That's not the way to do this.
Mm-hmm. And also watching one's language. Dismal economy. I was looking at some readings, and some people were talking about this being a dismal economy. I thought, I don't even want that to impact or invade my thought process. Maybe it's a challenging time, because I want to make sure that I get rid of that to be able to go and find those organizations or those companies that require assistance that I can provide value to. And I do want to talk very briefly about the proposal writing process, because that's where you really help me with looking at providing options of value, and writing a short, succinct proposal, unlike the ones that we did when I was with my former employer. If I don't want to have a job now, I want to have a consulting company, consulting and coaching. And instead of writing a 17-page proposal that would outline everything they could possibly do for the next 10 years, to keep it short, sweet, and give them options. So would you discuss what a great proposal would contain?
Well, a proposal is based on conceptual outcome with a buyer. So a proposal is a summation. It's not a negotiation. It's not a discussion. It's not an exploration. It's a summation of conceptual agreement. That means that you already have the objectives for the project, the metrics for success, and the value to the organization. So a proposal has 9 components. They fit in 2.5 pages, no matter what the size of the proposal is. So number one, what's the situation appraisal? A paragraph or two on why you're speaking. Number two is objectives. What are the business outcomes, not the deliverables, not the tasks? What are the business outcomes to be met? Number three, What are the metrics? How will you measure progress toward those objectives? You know, a metric is not people will be more confident. How would you know that? So they have to be identifiers. They have to be indicators. Number four, value. If we meet these objectives, what's the impact on the organization? And that's a very subtle and important nuance to get from the buyer because that will determine ROI later. Number five, methodology and options. What are our choices here to implement? If you give people a choice of options, a choice of yeses, psychologically you greatly increase their ability to make a choice for you in your favor because instead of saying, should I use Allen, they're saying, how should I use Allen?
Mm-hmm.
Number six is timing. How long will these different options take? Number seven is joint accountabilities. What are you responsible for? What am I responsible for? Number eight is terms and conditions, my favorite part. Here are the fees for the three options. This is the first time the buyer has ever seen the fees, first time. Here are the fees for the three options. Here are my terms, 50% on acceptance, 50% in 90 days, or whatever, and 10% off for 100% paid on acceptance. Here's how expenses will be charged, and here's what I won't charge. These are expenses, these are not. And then number nine is acceptance. You pick your option and you sign off here. Let me just stress, you know, you can do that in 2.5 pages no matter what the size. You don't have resumes on here. You don't have deep discussions of methodology. You don't have the values and belief system of your firm. Nobody cares. But it's all based on two things, that you're talking to a real buyer, that is somebody who has budget, and secondly, that you've already reached conceptual agreement. If you've done that, that's a proposal.
How does one find the true buyer? What kind of questions can one use to ferret that person out?
Well, you ask questions like this. Could you explain your decision-making process to me? And if somebody says, well, after I make a decision, it goes to a committee, or I submit this to my boss, you know, you're not dealing with a buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say to the buyer, I mean, it depends if you're in New York or California. You know, if you're California, you say something like this. Could you tell me, where would the funds come from to support this? If you're New York, you say something like this. Is this your budget? You know? You say to the person, look, if we shake hands, if we agree on everything, and we shake hands right now, could I start tomorrow? A buyer would shake your hand if the buyer wanted to go forward. A non-buyer would never do that because it's really a contract. That's an oral contract.
Yeah.
And so those are the kinds of questions you ask. And in a lot of my materials, I have a list of 10 or even 20 questions you can ask to determine if it's a real buyer. But, you know, the mistake that consultants and coaches and speakers and so forth make is they don't talk to the real buyer. They content themselves in HR or training or with low-level people, with gatekeepers, because they're afraid to go forward. And you really can't do that.
So one of the biggest shifts for me is the 10% reduction if they will just start right away and choose which option. I had not thought of doing that before. I'd always been on a retainer basis so that each month I knew what was coming in, and we talked about it as being a six-month or a year-long engagement. And being able to say, I will give you a 10% reduction in fees from the consultant standpoint, of course that money's in the bank, from the organization standpoint, or at least from the economic buyer standpoint, not having to lose that particular budget because it's already allocated, that was such a great gift that you gave back. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And I may be hopping around because there's so much that you've talked about, and I keep pulling bits of information out. So you talked about this being a marketing business, and I agree wholeheartedly. And for coaches that are on the call, the marketing that they may have done is quite a bit different than the marketing that consultants will do. Would you talk about the importance and necessity of a press kit and what goes in that?
Well, a press kit, or what you might call a media kit or a presentation kit, is a physical kit. Now, a lot of people will say, in an electronic age, you don't need this anymore, and I really disagree with that. I think you need both. Not everybody you meet is computer-oriented, and some people who even are computer-oriented want to take this with them somewhere and bend it back and put their feet up and read it. They might want to read it on a train. They might want to read it on vacation. They might want to read it at their office without turning their computer on. They might want to give it to somebody. Who knows? In any case, you need a physical press kit. And the press kit should consist of the following. There should be typical client results. There should be an array of your services. There should be a biographical sketch. There should be testimonials. There should be case studies. There should be articles that you've published or white papers or position papers you've published. There should be copies of interviews with you that you may have done and things like that. And this is an organic kit so that you can take things out and put things in and change things as the prospect merits or as things progress. And then you would do the same thing electronically. So if you're a speaker, you might want to put a photo in there. I mean, speakers love to have their photos and everything. They plaster them and everything, usually unnecessarily. But you're much better off having environmental photos. That is, you have articles in there that happen to show you dealing with someone and things like that. Anyway, that's a press kit. You put it in one of these big presentation folders. You have your name, company name, logo, contact info printed on it. Mine is embossed. It's a very high-end presentation kit that's embossed with my logo because I was dealing with very, very large firms and very, very sophisticated buyers.
Mm-hmm. And how to stand out. When you said white papers being published, you're not talking necessarily about published within a journal. You're talking about self-publishing in this case?
Well, not. I wouldn't call it self-publishing. I mean, you create a white paper that's 2 to 5 pages long. It's somewhat around your value statement, your value proposition, has your copyright on it, has your contact information, and you put that in your press kit. You put it on your website. You might put it on your blog, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And so if you do 2 of these a month, and you were asking me before what new people should be doing, if you were to do 2 of these a month, you know, in 6 months, you'll have a dozen of these, and you can certainly write more than that. In your press kit and on your website and so forth, that will start to represent that gravity, that intellectual capital, that expertise that we spoke about earlier.
All right, thank you. So this applies not just to people that are new to the business. It also applies to individuals that are in this current marketplace within the Phoenix area. One of the questions that we received was, in this economy, what's the single most important thing a small business consultant can do right now to get new clients?
You know, that's a good question, and I think I have a good answer. There's been a lot of research done. If you go to my blog, in fact, I continually print things on my blog about how the economy is better than people are letting on. This is really a perceptual recession. And you mentioned in your introduction about the numbers of small businesses in Phoenix. Well, mm-hmm. that's true across the country. Small business is the largest employer in the United States. Not large business. Small business, largest employer in the country. And so the answer to this question is, what you have to do is you have to go to these small businesses and encourage them that the rebound is coming and they will be in the best competitive position by investing now. The research I was referring to a few seconds ago, it was done by McGraw-Hill and others, and like I said, it's on my blog, shows that during the 80s recession, companies that invested in their growth, in themselves, during the recession, in themselves, grew at over 20% better averages than did companies that didn't invest when the recession ended. And so what you have to convince these small businesses are, now is the time to invest, to step out, to excel, to create a gap between you and the competition. And you can only do that by showing them immediate value. So that if you insist on dealing with the small business market, which is a tough market,
uh-huh.
and it's a tough market not because it's small business. It's a tough market because in small businesses, you're dealing with the owner and founder in many cases, so the decisions made are highly emotional. Much more emotional than in large companies. So, for example, with a smaller business, the owner is saying, do I need to invest this in the business or get my kids orthodontia or take an extra vacation to Florida, or maybe I should get that new car? Well, you know, the buyer in Hewlett-Packard is not concerned about that kind of comparison. So you have to deal with that and convince the buyer that all those personal objectives he or she wants are better attained by growing the business. That is, they're not mutually exclusive. And so you have to show how you can make that better. And you have to look around to find out the small businesses that have the best chances of growing and have ownership that's most open to these kinds of ideas. That's what you do if you're going to be in that business place.
So what are the kinds of industries that are still thriving, if not thriving, that are doing all right?
Well, if you look at who's hiring and who's doing well, healthcare services, mm-hmm. and large and small, anything to do with healthcare, retail, professional services, professional business services, financial services, believe it or not. So there's one or two more. I was just reading an article about this. One of them escapes me. I got it. Hotel and hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And especially at the lower end, you know. And so the Four Seasons hotels are having somewhat of a problem, but, you know, Marriott Courtyard is not. And so these and others, I'm just quoting one article I read, these and others are businesses and industries and professions that are growing, and so that's what you look at. You look at the fact, for example, you know, more people right now are turning toward preserving things rather than buying new things. So home repair and auto repair and do-it-yourself, all those kinds of things are thriving. And so maybe you should look at your local Home Depot. Maybe you should look at the, at somebody who owns a chain of tile stores. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you should look at a visiting nurses association or a dentist who owns five dental operations. That's the kind of thing, if you're going to look at small business, that's the kind of thing I'd be looking at.
So it's helping them to stay healthy in this kind of economy.
Well, no, not just stay healthy, helping them to understand that they're healthy now. They're doing pretty well now, because you asked me about businesses that are doing okay now.
Yeah.
But once this thing rebounds, and my belief is it's going to rebound much sooner than anybody thought.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody predicted this, and nobody is going to predict the end accurately, because nobody knows. Nobody has a clue. And from what I see, probably early 2010, this is going to start to turn around in a major way, not 2012, to convince these people that by making an investment in the consultant's expertise and value-added, when this does turn around, they'll be in even better shape, have better growth, have more customers, and so on.
And to make sure that the consultant or coach is visible enough and that they're not just in the background, woe is me, that they're out there, they're creating intellectual property, and that they are the object of interest so that they're the first person that someone thinks of as the economy changes.
Well, like I said, you have to install confidence in others. And so you have to be out there showing people the way. Enthusiasm's contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wants to deal with somebody who comes in and says, well, you know, you're probably right, it's a lousy economy. God, I haven't seen it so tough in ages. Who the hell wants to deal with that?
Yeah.
You know, you want to deal with somebody who says, look, I've got some great ideas, I've got some best practices, I've found firms that are doing really well. I can really help you shine in this economy so that when it gets even better, there'll be more of a gap between you and your competitors. That's how you have to talk.
One of my colleagues does work in strategic planning, and he said, you know, people aren't looking at strategic planning right now. I said, no, they're looking at implementation and making things happen quickly. And he said, yeah, you're right. I need to change some work that I'm doing. So you talked about abandoning business, and we didn't talk about it this morning, but you've talked previously about abandoning business. It's also abandoning old service, an old delivery, an old value, and hearkening to the new.
Well, if you... you know, you only can carry so much luggage, and so you have to let go to reach out. It sounds counterintuitive, but you have to let go of things to reach out because we all have a capacity limit. And if you're carrying around old clients who aren't profitable anymore or who don't interest you anymore or who are difficult to deal with, and you're carrying around old habits and old methodologies, you talked earlier about my reinventing myself. You know, last year was my best year ever. January was my best January ever. The first quarter of this year was my best first quarter ever. And 75% of what I'm making I wasn't doing 3 years ago. So you have to, you know, so even if I'm not sitting back saying, you know, I'm just going to relax and just accept what works, if I'm constantly changing, you know, somebody new to the profession or who's not at my level, and very few people are, need to change as rapidly as well. And you can't do that if you're carrying old baggage around.
Yeah. And you're talking about this being your best first quarter, and that's because you are working with people in professional services. Now, what I appreciate about you is that you've already been there. There's so many people that are saying that they are experts in social media and they're experts in all sorts of different things and helping other service professionals increase their business. But their whole client base is only other consultants or other coaches, and they've not been where you've been.
Well, let me tell you something. You know, this is what I call the ski instructor example. But
okay.
if you want to ski, you don't listen to somebody sitting in the chateau, in the chalet, with a glass of brandy telling you when you go up there next morning, here's what you do. You want to ski with somebody who goes up the hill with you, and you're staring at their rear end from 6 yards away, and they're doing what you want to do. And every once in a while, they look over their shoulder to make sure you haven't fallen on your head. Never accept coaching. Never accept mentoring. Never accept help from anyone who hasn't done what you want to do in quantity. In other words, you want to publish a book, I've published 32. Don't pay attention to somebody who publishes one book, or God forbid a self-published book, and then tells you, well, I know how to publish books. If you want to be a keynote speaker, then be coached by someone who is a successful keynote speaker. At one point, I was doing 30 to 50 keynotes a year, not by somebody who gives concurrent sessions or does one keynote every 3 years. If you want to be a consultant, then deal with somebody, be coached by somebody who has done it big time with some of the largest firms in the world, which I have. Don't go to people, you know, who just coach others. Don't go to people who haven't done it themselves. If you haven't done it yourself and in quantity and in volume, I'm not interested. And one other thing, unsolicited feedback is always for the sender. Ignore it. Only listen to solicited feedback. You know, I was doing the keynote for the Speakers Association of the United Kingdom in Birmingham. And after my keynote, at a break, at a little reception, a guy walks up to me, and of course he's a speech coach. What else the hell would he be? And he says, do you mind if I gave you some feedback? And I said, is there anything in the entire British Empire that could stop you right now? Because I really don't want to hear it. And he says to me, when you walk around the stage, I have trouble listening to your points. But when you stay in one place and talk, then your points strike home. Do you know what I call that? I said, I'll tell you what I call it, a learning disability. And I just won't put up with this crap. You know, everybody's got an opinion, but you become like a pinball in a pinball machine. And so don't listen to unsolicited feedback, and never listen to people who haven't done what you want to do. Listen to people you ask, and listen to people you respect. Other than that, I don't feel strongly about it.
I could tell. This is not something you're passionate about at all. Let me turn to something else that you're not passionate about. Social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, after I heard all the stuff about social media, like anything else, you know, I joined a few of these platforms so that I could speak about them knowledgeably. I mean, I'm a member of Mensa so that I can debunk Mensa, because I think it's a bunch of self-appointed people who simply got lucky and scored well on a test. But, you know, if there's intelligent life in the universe, it's not in Mensa. But I joined it so I could speak about it that way. So consequently, I joined the social media platform. So I am on Twitter. I have 700 followers, 670-something followers on Twitter, and growing every day. I joined Facebook. I have a couple hundred friends there. And I joined LinkedIn, where I have 4.5 million people in my, you know, sphere, to see what all the talk was about. And what I found is that, ironically, you know, Nesbitt 30 years ago talked about high-tech, high-touch, and people are using things like Facebook to, in a high-tech world, to create high-touch, but with technology. I mean, it's nuts. It's ironic. Now, let me say this. If you want to get in touch with old buddies, if you want to stay in touch with people, you know, not by phone but by this kind of medium, there's nothing wrong with that. If you're looking for a job, not a prospect, you know, not a client, but if you're looking for a job to be employed somewhere, I can understand LinkedIn, and I can understand Facebook, and all that makes sense. And if you're looking to hear news before anybody else does, I mean, I found out Michael Jackson died on Facebook and Twitter, but then I went to the New York Times, which printed an L.A. Times story, which verified it. So I can see that stuff happening. But these people who tell you they're getting clients through these social media, now I'm talking about corporate clients here. I'm not talking about low-fee individual people who you're helping, you know, you're manicuring their nails. But if you're talking about key corporate clients, you're not going to get them this way. And stop fooling yourself. And for the people who say, you know, oh, I've got, I'm an exception, I got this. Well, there's an exception to everything. But, you know, take it with a pound of salt. I'll tell you one other thing. I checked out all these people following me. I checked them out on Twitter, the people who themselves are followed the most, thousands and thousands of followers, and almost to a person. They are people who are making money from the social media. They are people who have a vested interest in the social media platform working. What they do is they advise people on how to use Twitter. They advise people on how to use Facebook. So, of course, they're going to be advocates of it.
Absolutely.
So, like I said, always check the source. So if you want to do this as a hobby, fine. And I'll tell you, if you already have a brand, things always work better. You know, my blog is successful because I had a great brand going into it. And I find blogs different from the social platforms, by the way. But it's a huge time dump. And I found people on Facebook posting dozens of times a day who I know are having trouble with their own businesses. And instead they're spending their time there. It's just crazy.
So it's not marketing. It's just a time sink.
It's a big time dump. You have to be very careful.
CIO Zone had an article a couple of days ago talking about all the so-called experts on Twitter. And all they are is they're Twitter spammers. And so they're sending out a lot of information saying, I'm the best, I know all this stuff. And again, if you have 20,000 followers, are people following it? Absolutely not. I did a couple of tests myself to see if anybody even responded. I was looking for a videographer. And so I sent out to my... I think it was to Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, I believe all of them. So I was doing it as an experiment, and nobody even responded, and I thought, this is fascinating. So here I am looking to hire somebody, and nobody even got back to me. When you use Twitter, though, you are doing something, I think, from a strategic perspective. Is that true?
Well, yeah. I put 100, over the course of a month or so, I put up 100 Million Dollar Consulting Insights. So my brand was there every day. Million Dollar Consulting, registration, the R, Insight, and I've published 100 of them that are different. Now I'm talking about things, even on Facebook, I'm starting conversations with people that are deeper than, you know, what kind of tree do you resemble and which part of your anatomy do you know best, which are basically what you hear on Facebook. I'm engaged in conversations about capitalism versus philanthropy and things like that. And so I want, and you know, people get upset with that, or people, to, you know, people are upset that I don't follow anybody. So I did this podcast, it's on my blog right now, contrarianconsulting.com. Mm-hmm. And the podcast talks about some guy on Twitter from Australia who's just irate that I wouldn't follow him. I don't follow anybody on Twitter. I don't feel a need to. But as somebody said to me, but that's so typical of your brand. You know, you've got all these followers, you're not following anyone. And so you do use it strategically. You have to use these things with intelligence, not just show up there every day and spend time there.
So with something like Twitter, when you are strategic, and I'm not just using Twitter as the example, I'm allowing this to be broader, when you are looking at what you're going to be posting, do you have in your mind the top 100 or whatever the posts are going to be, and then sit down and write those at one time so that you are leveraging your time?
Oh, no, 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 no. I go on Twitter, I put in a $1 million consulting insight number 34, and I decide what it will be.
Okay, thank you.
Listen, if you're in this business and you can't come up with 100 things on the spur of the moment, you know, as you want to write them, to help people improve, then you got some work to do.
Well, you're different in that you have been doing this for such a long time. You have the 10,000 hours in, so that you can pull things very quickly, very readily, say, you know, these are the top 10, or these are the 20, or the 100, whatever it is.
So it's got nothing to do with hours. There are people who have been this as long as I have who do the same thing over and over again every day. What it has to do with is innovation. It has to do with the ability to look around you and see things from a different perspective.
Okay.
I have to tell you, the fact that I started in 85 is just an accident of chronology. It's an accident of history. But if I started 5 years ago, I'd still be doing what I'm doing now. I mean, I maybe wouldn't be at the same point yet, but the fact is that you have to be willing to explore. And if it were just a matter of how long you were around, all these veterans in IMC would all be making a fortune, but they're not.
So then I want to look at it slightly differently. You are able to use the same material and bring innovation in because you are so aware of what's going on around your surroundings. So what I've noticed is Contrarian Consulting, you'll see something that occurs, and you'll either create an instance for how to convey that to people, or it becomes a metaphor.
That's exactly right.
And that's a big difference between what I see with other folks, where they are talking about something that is mundane or inane, either one. So you're doing it from a strategic perspective, and you're very observant at the same time. So it's inward out.
No argument.
All right. Good. Thank you. Let me see if there's any other questions. There is one that did come in from someone saying...
How much time we have left?
We have 7 more minutes.
Okay.
You still good for that?
Yeah.
All right. So a question did come in to ask, how do you determine the value of the upfront?
How do you determine value of a project?
Of a project, yes.
Well, you do it with the client. You do it with the buyer, and you ask the buyer, what are the objectives to be obtained, attained, which are business outcomes? What are the indicators of success so we know we make progress? And then what's the value to the company if we reach them? And you ask the questions of the buyer. And that's the key. And that's why self-esteem is so important. You got to be willing to sit there in a nice office with a powerful person who has traditionally seen consultants as vendors who ought to be in HR and push back. And you got to say, you know, well, what will this mean to you? Well, I don't know, it'll be better. Well, what do you mean it'll be better? Obviously, you're taking the time to talk to me. Well, I will improve. Well, how much will you improve? Where will you improve? Who will improve? Who will notice it? Those are the questions you have to ask. So the buyer provides value. And that way, I said before that was an important nuance, if you remember. Mm-hmm. That way, when the buyer gets the proposal, the buyer has said, yeah, that's right. These are my words. I agree. That's right.
And are they actually articulating what that dollar value will be in all cases?
Say that again, Sil?
Are they articulating what the dollar value would be? No.
Okay. It doesn't have to always be a dollar value. There's quantitative improvement, which is about dollars. It's about reducing turnover or improving market share or improving profitability, things like that. But there's also qualitative improvement, such as you're freeing up my time, you're reducing stress, we have a better public image and things like that. And those are all fine, too. This is art and science, and that's the art part.
All right.
So now you look at the size of the organization, and you look at the impact of the buyer. I mean, does a buyer have a $2 million budget and 1,000 people? You know, where's the buyer in that organization? And you make some judgments about how important this is and what the difference would be. There's a formula in many of my books, and what it says is the quantitative improvement times the annualization, because, of course, you get the improvement over a number of years, plus the qualitative improvement times the emotional impact plus peripheral benefits, those equal the value. And if you put that over the fee, then you have the return on the investment.
And then not sending that proposal forward, actually presenting it to the individual. Do you recommend that people send anything via FedEx or only face-to-face? Or
no, not face-to-face. Never face-to-face because
okay.
The buyer will get it and say, this is interesting, I need some more time to go through it. So what you do is you FedEx it or send it electronically. I prefer FedEx all the time, but, I mean, if the buyer wants it electronically, I'll do both. But I prefer FedEx because you have a hard copy with your signature with no symbol scrambled on your letterhead and so on. So you send it by FedEx and or electronically. You tell the buyer that this reflects our understanding, and I'm going to call you Friday at 10 o'clock, and we'll decide which option you want. And you call Friday at 10 o'clock. That's what you do.
And that's very clean. Yeah. And I like the idea of having this signed copy as well. And that was another 1% improvement for me. By having that signed copy, it just meant they signed it back and faxed it in return, and we got started.
That's right.
Made a big difference.
In fact, you can even put in, if you want to, you can even put in different invoices for the different options and your own FedEx return. And they can actually get the invoice approved, sign it, and FedEx the check back to you. So there's a lot of things you can do here.
Oh, another 1% improvement. Thank you. All right. There was one last question that had come in, and this is one that was presented before. So this is an individual that wants to be in a consulting role, and yet they seem to be in a training role. How does one shift the mind of the end buyer? Or the economic buyer, from instead of being a consultant or a coach to something else they want to be, especially if all their testimonials say this person's been a great trainer for years.
What you have to do with the buyer is re-educate the buyer, and you have to say, you know, we've been working in this capacity for a long time, and right now I'd like to present to you different ways we can work.
Yep.
And so you have to re-educate the buyer so that. That you can get that done.
Okay. And I can hear Buddy barking in the background. Is that right?
Yeah, that's Buddy because there's somebody. Somebody came.
Okay.
So, my watchdog here. FedEx comes every day here, but Buddy wants to make sure that people know that he's on the job.
And that he gets his biscuit.
Yeah, that's right. So, in any case, you have to re-educate the buyer so that the buyer can see you in a new light. And that happens to be a very good question because that's not easy to do. And sometimes you'll have to take a few meetings or some even more subtle things like sending them things in writing and new ideas to make that happen.
And I would think also increasing the amount of intellectual property that's out on the person's website to say, this is what I do. These are my successes.
Right, but don't forget, buyers don't troll websites.
Ah, that's right, yeah.
And so you really have to be a little more aggressive in convincing the buyer. You never want to say, visit here, do this, check this link. You never want to make people work. And I get that all the time. People want me to do something. I don't click links. I don't go places. If you really want to impress me, show me something.
I've learned that from you. I never send you links anymore. I send you information, excuse me, as opposed to having you click on links. I want to say one thing that I've learned from working with you is that you have helped me to crisp up my thinking significantly so that I'm able to reduce the amount of information, reduce the amount of work that the buyer will do, and it's all through working with you. And so as a consequence, my delivery style, my thinking style, my proposals, all of that has changed, and also my discretionary time has changed exponentially. I no longer am tied to the phone, as most coaches are, so I don't sit and wait for our 10 o'clock appointment or our 12 o'clock appointment. My clients now decide when they contact me, when they need me. That's been a huge shift for me. So I really appreciate having worked with you for the last year and some.
My pleasure, Sil.
So, Alan, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Sil.
And his websites are contrarianconsulting.com, that is the blog, and summitconsulting.com. Thank you again, Alan, and we'll talk with you soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.